we're going to deal with today are some things that perhaps are new to you. Some of you have heard it before, I'm sure, and some of you will have to think it through on your way back various places. My friend Granger Westberg has been very popular over the last 20 years, perhaps, talking about two things. First, he used the phrase psychosomatic medicine. And now he's talking about, and he's running, holistic health clinics. Holistic health, meaning you treat the whole person. You don't treat this organ versus that organ. And you don't run to the guy who takes care of pimples on your nose, and then you go to another guy for asthma. You know, you've got all these specialties that are cut down. We don't deal with that anymore. We're dealing with holistic. Now, the Old Testament is completely holistic as its definition of the human being. And I'd like you to turn. We're going to look at two passages rather quickly, but they're basic, and then we're going to look at a number of other passages to look at what the various so-called parts of humanity or the personhood is in the Old Testament. And I say so-called parts because I'll try to explain that as we go further along. Turn to Genesis first. Genesis 2, chapter 7. We'll get to the Genesis 1 toward the end of the lesson because that's a different subject. Somebody want to read from any version? Genesis 2, verse 7.
Then the Lord God took some soil from the ground and formed the man out of it. He breathed life-giving breath into his nostrils, and the man began to live.
Okay, that's one of the Living Bible, I think, is it?
No, Good News.
Good News, all right. You note how clearly they say at the end, he breathed breath, and he became, what's the end of it?
And the man began to live.
Man began to live. It doesn't say like the King James, he became a living soul or something of the sort. The RSV in the Jerusalem Bible used the phrase, he became a living being. A living being. And that's unity, you know, that's a very simple thing. Let me just do a little diagram, because I'm going to use it in reverse when we look at the next passage. We sort of got the Spirit of God up here, which has been hovering around for a long time, and the Hebrew word is Ruach. The Ruach breathes, and that's another word. Sometimes Spirit can mean this, but this happens to be another word. Breath, that's the word for breath. I better put the fact that this is a noun. He breathed the breath of life, and we can put the word life down just so you have it all here, which is Chaya. I sometimes start writing Hebrew and sometimes start writing English, so it doesn't help. I guess that's the best way to do it. Chaya. It's a sort of a huh. And then man breathed that into dust, and I'm not going to bother with the Hebrew word for dust because that's an important. And then he became a living being, or he began to live, as the translation we just had. Note the four elements that are involved. God or God's Spirit breathes breath into the dust, and man becomes a living being. Or even if you want to still use it, I think one of the words that ought to be kicked out of the Bible is the word soul, because it has so many ramifications that get us into trouble. He became a living being, or he began to live. It's good that these newer translations are eliminating the word soul. King James doesn't. RSV in the Jerusalem Bible. Jerusalem Bible is my favorite translation, except for one thing. In some of the other passages in the Old Testament, not in this one, they still use the word soul. And that causes people lots of trouble. Now, death is the opposite practice. Genesis doesn't talk about death in the same way, but if you look at Ecclesiastes 12, verse 7, will you turn to Ecclesiastes? It's interesting that Genesis 2, 7, and Ecclesiastes 12, 7. The first six verses of Ecclesiastes are basically about my aging, and about my losing teeth, and my losing the high-pitched sounds, and they make a myth about my losing my sexual drive. I won't admit to that yet. And then they have some other things that are involved in that whole story about Ecclesiastes 12, verses 1 through 6. And then you have those beautiful phrases about The golden bowl is broken and the pitcher is broken at the fountain. And you remember those images of death, very poetic images. Then comes verse 7. Who wants to read verse 7 to me?
And the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it.
Okay.
Wait a minute, I guess there's a little more. No, that's verse 8.
Yeah, that's enough. In other words, dust is left, and the livingness stops, and the spirit or the breath goes back to God. The breath always belongs, or the spirit of livingness is always God's. It isn't something I hold as a separate possession of myself. It isn't something that I have for myself. It's God's spirit, or if you don't want to use God's spirit, it's God's breath. If you don't want to use God's breath, you can use it God's power. If you don't want to use power, I like the word vitality. It's God's vitality that makes me live. And vitality is just using the Latin word for life. That's all that's doing. So I'm really saying God's life-giving power makes the dust live. Then when the life-giving power is pulled out, you know, we sometimes use the phrase, you pull the rug out of somebody and they collapse. Well, if God pulls his life-giving vitality, his power out from under me, I collapse into dust and earth. And as Ed read, I return to the earth from which I came. And there isn't any me. We'll talk about what happens after death toward the end of this hour. Now, do you follow what we're saying? We've got to get that very clear because that's going to be basic. First of all, life is not my possession. Life is a gift of God by the power of God. The word spirit and the word breath can be interchanged as breath or spirit or power. And I'll get to the Greek in a moment because that's where our hang-up comes from. And then we have all kinds of words for that. All the way through. We're talking about the reaction of God's power for life on inanimate dust. The most unchristian poem in the whole of modern romantic literature is Wordsworth's Odes on Intimations of Immortality. Our sleep is but a birth and a forgetting. That's the Greek. That's the business that God's got a bunch of little souls up here, or else there's a whole motor pool of souls up there, and when intercourse takes place and conception takes place, they peel one off and send it out for action. And then when death happens, that one goes back to the motor pool for resurfacing, and then you get into the whole idea of, is there such a thing as reincarnation in Christianity? If you want to believe that Platonic thing, you might want to push it all the way. That when it gets back there, I come back. We're going to throw another word out later on, along with soul. I'll just hint that it is the word resurrection. Because it, again, has so many things. I'd like to talk about the word revitalization or recreation. Because resurrection is tied up with putting me back together again. As if two parts have been separated, and they then take me like a piece of plywood and they laminate me. They bring soul and body together. And my dad didn't believe in cremation for years because cremation was the way the atheists and agnostics thumbed their nose at the resurrection. You know, if you scatter it all over, you're going to make it hard for God to bring all those parts together and then pull a little soul back down here, put it together, and then raise you. Gradually, Dad recognized that the human being was a totality and that it was the life of God that made me a human being, not something I possessed by myself, inherent in myself. And so that was a very important part of life. Now, where we all go wrong, and I'm going to deal with some other people, I use the word psychosomatic. And that's an attempt to say it's a wholeness, it's a totality. And the thing that's a problem here is, in the Greek Old Testament, and in the Greek New Testament, psyche, and put it like that, psyche, like in psychology, translated the word soul, or being. And we put all the Greek into that. I haven't given you a word for being yet, living being yet. I'll give it to you in a minute because I want to get this out of the way. And then this word was the Greek word for body. Soma. Psuche and soma were the two words that were put together in this modern medicine idea. But when the Greeks translated this word, nephesh, and then you put the chaya again, the beingness of life, or the livingness of being, or however you want to literally translate, the nephesh chaya, it turned over as psyche, or suke, and that's caused us all the trouble. Because whenever anybody sees soul in English or psuche in Greek, they start thinking about that Greek concept and they forget that it never meant that in Old Testament and very seldom means it in New Testament. I'll get to that sometime before we quit today as to what it means. Now I'd like you to look up a couple of other passages for me, and we're going to talk about death first, and then we're going to talk about the parts of mankind and what they mean, and then give you a little discussion, and then we'll go on to the New Testament and what that's all about. I have some questions so far. Let's give it time for questions. Do you follow what I'm pushing? I'm pushing a totality, a wholeness, on the basis of God's Spirit, not some little particle or some little image or something else. Yeah, Pastor?
The Greek idea is connected with this dichotomy of immortality and mortality.
It has some of that in it, right, that the soul is possibly going to continue living back up there in the motor pool.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, right, and the body dies, whereas when I stop living, just as when I started living, I was either I or I wasn't I. I was never half I. And that's the trouble we have with most of our resurrection stories and most of our doctrines of humanity. We think of half a person existing afterwards, and then you gather up the rest and then you make them whole afterwards. But I'm nothing until the Spirit of God vitalizes me. And at the end of my life, I'm nothing until God recreates me or revivifies me. We'll talk about graves, death, and fatherhood, and the pit, and Sheol, and Hades in a little bit. Some other questions or additions you want to ask?
Yes, maybe we're going to bring this up later, but...
You want it now, fine.
Well, it has to do with this passage that
sure.
I tried to read here.
Go ahead.
The dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Now, we have to reject that today, don't we?
No, that's perfectly good. It's God's vital spirit. God gave me life. God took life. He doesn't take my soul. He just takes my life. The spirit returns to God. God is the giver of all good and perfect
gifts.
This
does not imply separation of soul and body.
Of course not. Of course not.
Well, and that's okay.
It says the vitality, the vital urge, the whim, vigor, and vitality which God has given me is God's. And when he takes that away, there's no umhow half up there or a quarter up there or any way up there. God's up there, and he's got all his power, all his life-giving, all his creative power. And when he uses it again in the resurrection, then there might be an umhow around. We'll get to that. No, that's a good passage. That's one of the best passages about death you can find in the Bible.
What returns to the earth as it was?
This carcass, this corpse, becomes dust and earth. And that's why we say in the funeral service, dust to dust, ashes to ashes. We know that's what happens. And that's what happens to me. I disappear until God revivifies me and recreates me. That passage in Ecclesiastes is the exact reverse of Genesis 2:7. In other words, one says how I got to be alive and got to be me, and the other one says how I died and stopped being me. They're exact parallels, only in the opposite direction.
I always thought it implied the separation. So.
That's right, because that's the way we always read it, Ed. You're right, that's the way I was even taught, too.
I was taught that.
Yeah, because you see, we read back into the Old Testament the old Platonic idea of separation of soul and body. And we acted as if that spirit equaled soul. But it's an altogether different word. It's ruach. It's the spirit of God, the vitality, the power of God that goes back to God. It's not even the breath, the net. Namasha, or the nephesh. See, if it were nephesh, we might have been able to say, well, maybe it is the same as psuche. But it isn't. The Greek equivalent of ruach, and I guess we might as well get that out here since Ed's brought up as a question. The Greek equivalent of ruach is pneuma, which is the word that's used for Holy Spirit. It's the word that's used for pneumatic tires. It's the word that's used for pneumonia. It's got all kinds of Latin-English connections from the Greek into us. And it's the spirit of livingness that is in God's hands. It doesn't say soul goes back, but so many of us equated spirit and soul, so that when we read that word, and my profs did too, Ed, in seminary, they said very clearly, that spirit going back is my soul, and that earth is my body. They don't do that. Let me give you a couple other passages. If we use this word nephesh, I'm going to put a pronoun on it. Nafshi, sometimes it's an A, sometimes it's a very short E, and so on. And this is the pronoun my. Frequently in the Psalms, frequently in the historical books, you hear the word and see the word my soul. My soul means my livingness, my nephesh. And in many of the modern translations, they don't use soul, they don't use life, they just say I, or me. When David says, my soul rejoices in the Lord, it could be just as well translated, I rejoice. When David says, my soul hungers, and then he goes and eats the showbread in the temple, he could have said, I'm hungry. In other words, nephesh is in a way the equivalent of the word self. My beingness, myself. Let's look up a couple passages like that just for fun.
Let me ask a change of thought here. Is it in the translation? Of
yes.
The Greek and the Hebrew?
The translation is what caused the trouble. The Greeks translated it with psuche and made it soul, and that's what we read into it, whereas it really means living being or self or vitality, that livingness. And soma, most of the time the word for body, which I'll talk to basar, might as well say it now since you brought it up. The word for body in the Hebrew is basar or kalil, and both of them mean either flesh, like butcher's meat hung up on a hook, or corpse. Neither of which have any life, you see. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's butcher's meat, that's not much life. When you go through the Near East and you see all those things with the flies and the maggots eating them out to make them tenderer for you when you get into the hotel, that's dead meat. The flies are alive, the maggots are alive, the meat's dead. And that's the word basar, which is translated frequently flesh or body. And the other word really means dead corpse. So they seldom use the word body in the Hebrew at all. There's not a decent word for body, except for dead bodies. Another
May
question.
I ask, sure. Is there a soul in them?
Okay, now that's the $64,000 question that people ask when I've said this. There is no soul in the Greek sense of the word, that it has independent existence, that then goes back and has independent marking time in eternity. Because there isn't any time in eternity. Eternity is the opposite of time. So there's nothing up there for me to wait for. First of all, I'm not even there unless I've been recreated and resurrected. If you want to use soul in the proper sense, then I am a soul. The totality of me equals soul. If you insist on continuing using the word, use this little phrase to keep it straight. I think it'll help. It's a long time, must have been in the 20s, that an English theologian came up with this little sort of a doublet. Man does not have a soul, he is a soul. Do you follow the difference? If I have a soul, then it can go away and still be part. It can be alive, it can be all kinds of things. But if I am a soul, when I live, I am a soul. When I die, I stop being a soul. I'm a corpse. God's still alive. God's spirit's still alive. And that's the Ecclesiastes passage, Ed. God's still vital. And God resurrects me. And if I want to insist, he resurrects my soul. But that's why the Apostles' Creed says, I believe in the resurrection of the body
Any damn fool Greek believed in the immortality of the soul. Well, that was nothing new, and it wouldn't be worth having it in your confession. So we leave it out, deliberately. If I were retranslating the Apostles' Creed, and they didn't ask me about the international translation of the Apostles and the Nicene Creed and the New Green Hymnal, I translate, I believe in the recreation of the being. That wouldn't make sense, but people would get all kinds of things to do that. I believe in the revivification of the self. That's what I believe in. But they were trying to say it's the total person. See, the Greeks were believing only part of you got to be immortal. Only your soul. The Hebrews are saying, and so are the Christians, if there's anything that's immortal, it's all of them, hell. It's going to be resurrected again. Nothing's really immortal. But if there's anything that's going to have eternal life, it's all of them, hell. I grew up in the 30s, and I think there was a torch song that was being sung. Come and take all of me. Do any of you remember that song? Come and take all of me. Well, that's biblical. That's biblical. Psalm 103, and I was going to spend time on Psalms, but I don't have time, but I'll bring it in now. Psalm 103, Psalms are parallel. If you don't know what the first line means, you read the second line, and it tells you what it means.
Doublets.
They're doublets, or they're antonyms, they're parallel verses, they're all kinds of words you can call it. Bless the Lord, O my soul,
and
all that is within me, bless his holy name. Things that are equal to the same thing are equal to each other. Bless the Lord, my soul, all that is within me is my soul. So, bless the Lord, O Umhal, all of Umhal, bless his holy name. That's all it's saying. And that's a good way to get a definition. Look at some of the Psalms. We'll do that when we get to death and Sheol and the pit and the grave and all that, because the Psalms will help us out. Another question, does that help a little bit? Okay, another question over here. I think I saw one.
I have a very poor memory for names, but what do you do with these passages in the Bible where they saw someone sitting in heaven and this person went to heaven without death and so on and so forth? What do you do about that?
I have no problem with that. Other people do, but I have no problem at all. Because if heaven is where God is and the resurrected saints are, including me when I'm resurrected, and it's out of time, it's just that these characters down here are still looking at watches. Those people up there aren't looking at watches. And so they have been recreated, resurrected. You're not looking at a reflection of a part of them. You know, you're not just seeing a part of the soul of Moses or Elijah or Dives or Abraham or even Abraham's bosom. You know, either he's got a whole bosom or he ain't there. That kind of thing, you know, you've got to remember. So our problem is that we have also misdefined eternity. We define, I'm sorry I'm throwing so much, but you see how they interconnect? You ask one question, you throw into another subject. And that's not a digression, Ed, but it sounds like it sometimes. We define eternity almost the same as we define infinity, as if it's time extended to no end. But that's not Old Testament or New Testament. Eternity is a change of status, a change of state, where there is no time, and where you're out of the world of the flesh and the blood and the devil, and you're into the world of God. And it's being with God that makes it eternity, not that there's some long infinity of timeline. But most of us may equate eternity and infinite time. Those are contradictory statements. Eternity is non-time. So when you define eternity by infinite time, you've already contradicted yourself. So that's why I have no trouble with those people. You know, they're resurrected. They haven't been waiting for the body to be gathered. You know, the old cremation was that these guys were going to scatter it over Lake Chelan, all their ashes, and then they were hoping some of those fish are going to eat some of those ashes. And then they were hoping some of the Holden villagers were going to eat some of the fish. And then they'd die, and then some bears would eat some of their bodies and bones. And then we dare God to put us back together again. You know, and that's what cremation was for a time in some places in the United States. It wasn't always that. It's a perfectly legitimate Christian way of doing things. Has been for years. But when we got into agnosticism and a few things around here, we began to look at it another way. And so my father, who was at the place where Ed is now a pastor, for many years wouldn't even have a funeral for a cremation. Talk people out of having cremations, and if they insisted on having it, he wouldn't perform it. Toward the end of his life, he recognized, you know, God doesn't have to have the pieces to put me back together again. If God can create like that in the first place, God can recreate in the second place. He doesn't have to gather up. There's a question over here.
Well, I want to first make a statement.
Sure, that's legitimate too.
You are throwing so much that I can hardly absorb it as we go on. But then again, if these pieces are going to go back together, that's the concept, because that's how I thought all these years. But if that could be wiped out up here.
That's the problem, isn't it?
You bet.
Mm-hmm.
But then there would be a real concept of what does a glorified body mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because there is something, too, that we have pondered ourselves. What do you think a glorified body is?
Thanks for throwing in another issue. But I have no problem with that one any more than I do with this. A glorified body is Paul's way of saying a recreated human being. Without the sin, you know, we've tried to describe it. We've tried to use physical things. We've tried to use spiritual, we try to use Greek. All he's saying is, that's what the resurrection body is. It's got to be different from this one. But the resurrected, glorified body is merely saying, it's the person in eternity, recreated by God. To me, that's very simple. Now, maybe it's confusing. Does it?
Oh, well, your intellect is so far up above mine that...
Well, keep spinning, it's fun. I'll go over toward the end. I'll sort of review one step at a time, because these things go together. Another question before we move on to looking at a couple of these things that words say, the word self, and then we want to look at the various parts of the body, and then we want to deal, if we have time, with the images of man. And then I think it's Friday or Saturday we'll deal with Psalm 51, which I was going to deal with anyhow, but that deals with sin in man. And what is sin, and what are we talking about? Now that's another subject. Somebody else? Yes?
When does this recreation take place?
Okay. Throw another curve at the lady who's getting dizzy over here. If we can eliminate the concept that eternity is endless time, and that there is no time in eternity, then the question when, from eternity's point of view, is irrelevant, right? Because the word when is a time word, right? And I'm not quitting your question. From the point of view of us who still wear wristwatches and look at stopped clocks and all kinds of things and try to find out where we are and what time it is, when does the resurrection take place? From this point of view down here, it takes place down the end. That's what the Bible says about a sort of a second resurrection. But if I move from life to life, it's quicker than that. I can't snap my fingers fast enough. The resurrection, because I move from life to recreated life quicker than a hummingbird's wing can flutter once. See, I'm in time again. I can't even give you an analogy without using time. It's immediate, if that's the best word I can say. Recreation takes place immediately, so that when we see ashes, or we donate our body to the medical school, or we are burned up in a car wreck with a Pinto having trouble, or whether we have a normal casket burial and just let it, you know, we say the vault is for eternity, don't we? It really isn't. God's not going to raise that vault up with him. That's something, we get recreated. All I can use is the word immediate. Now let me use another illustration. Some of you know that Betty is my second wife. My first wife died back in 1953. From Dorothy's point of view, and I've used this illustration before, I see Vern Rieke smiling over there, he's heard this before. From Dorothy's point of view, there was no time lapse between the time when she died in her bed at home and she was resurrected. She passed from life to life. She passed from time to eternity. She passed from earth to heaven, if you want to use that kind of a phrase. change that immediately. But for me, she died in 1953, and that's 26 years or so ago, right? And from my point of view, she isn't resurrected yet. And that's where you get the first and the second resurrections in the New Testament. You know, everybody is resurrected immediately. But at the end of the world, we all recognize there it is, and we're all raised together, caught up together. And if there's some people who aren't dead yet, that's when they're caught up in the air to join the rest who are already recreated. Paul's only trying to say, don't think because you haven't died yet, you won't make it. That's all he's trying to tell the people. He says, they won't get more than you get. See, the word more seems like time again. Is Dorothy going to have 26 more years of heaven than I'm going to have? Now, that's a silly question in a way, isn't it? Well, that's almost like Catholics or Buddhists or somebody saying there are stages in heaven there. You get special rewards. She gets 26 years more than I do. Whether she was better than me or not is irrelevant. There's no time over there, so there's no 26 years more. Do you follow? From her point of view, 26 years haven't gone by. Is that helpful or just something to contemplate? Something to contemplate. All right, we'll set it that way.
Well, then, with that analogy,
sure.
53, 79, and I die in 93, they're all the same time.
Exactly. If you want to use the word time, I'd have to say exactly, yes. It's all the same moment because you've transferred from time to eternity.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore you don't
right.
use yardsticks.
Very good.
Clocks.
You agree with me.
Well, it's always good to find at least one person agrees with me. All right, a couple more.
Well,
go ahead. Yeah.
How do you square this up with the Jesus' second coming? I've always thought that we were sort of in the state of limbo until the second coming, where he's mm-hmm. coming, where John says in Revelation that the first to be raised will be ones that believe in the grave, and that were in the grave, they would be.
Mm-hmm. No, Dorothy's already raised, so she's first.
But Jesus hasn't come to this world.
That's right. When he comes, I'll know she's been raised first. Now I only
can you'll know.
Yeah. Now I can only theorize
that she or myself, the way I would be immediately.
The second coming is like the second judgment that we sometimes talk about, the public judgment. It's when all of us know what's happened. But some of us are still going to be living when that happens, when he comes or when he judges. And so it's another point of view.
Would this be accepted by Bible?
No, it would not be accepted by people who are millennialists, who think that we have 1,000 years of certain dimension of either warfare or peace. They disagree among themselves as to what the 1,000 years is supposed to be. No, most Lutherans, and here's another term that I didn't think we'd get into, but we did. Most Lutherans are amillennialists. That's like atheists. Atheists, meaning they don't believe in it. So ah means there ain't no millennium. Like atheist means there ain't no God. That's rather colloquial, but that's what it means. So when you say amillennialists, most Lutherans are amillennialists. But there are a few. One of my friends, Ted Hacks, was one, I think, from Columbus who went out to the Bible Institute out in California. He was a premillennialist, which meant that Christ comes before the millennium starts, the 1,000 years. Most Lutherans are not pre- or post-millennialists.
What do we do with that? Just throw it out of the Bible?
No, we just say that very simply that the millennium has to do with the, not 1,000 years literally, but it has to do with the reign of Christ in his kingdom and his church. So that it started as soon as the resurrection started. That's what most Lutherans believe. The difficulty with the millennium is there are only one or two passages where it's even mentioned in the Bible, and it's very difficult to say, because if a day in your courts is worth 1,000 years, then what's 1,000 years? You know, so again, you see, we're out of time. If God doesn't wear a wristwatch, and I don't think he does, if God doesn't wear a wristwatch, then is eternity 1,000 years or is it one day? And that's where we get difficulty with the images in the Old and New Testament. What's 1,000 years mean is just as bad as when they say a myriad of angels are coming or a myriad of Assyrians are coming. A myriad theoretically meant 10,000, like a division in the U.S. Army during World War II. That's literal. When you say a myriad's coming, do you mean 10,000 on the head? Have they numbered them off and put them in ranks? I said, here they come. I think it means a damn large number. Yes?
Well, when there's no time then there's no age.
Right.
So therefore, if my brother died as a little boy, would he be recreated as a little boy?
I have no answer to that. We don't know what we will look like. We don't even know whether we'll recognize Dorothy when I get there. There's no statement in the Bible that says one way or the other. Doesn't say we won't. Don't misunderstand me. I didn't say we won't recognize each other. But your little brother wouldn't recognize you if you die at 95. So, you know, we got that whole problem in there. You might not recognize him if he doesn't age. And if he does age, it'll be even worse. And of course, we don't know a thing. There's absolutely nothing in Old or New Testament which says we'll recognize each other. The closest thing we got to saying anything about that is that there'll be no marriage or giving in marriage. That doesn't mean we won't necessarily recognize our spouse or will. It doesn't say when. It just means that we probably won't have sex relations in heaven. It probably also means that we won't necessarily have new relationships established. That's what it says. It doesn't say whether we will or not recognize former spouses.
I know in funeral services they'll say, well, you'll see each other in heaven, but if we don't recognize each other, then...
Yeah, I've never used that phrase. It's a dangerous phrase to use. We'll all be in heaven and we'll all see Jesus, and Jesus will see us. But boy, it's like Psalm 8, or like the Michigan Notre Dame football game last Saturday, you know, 105,000 people. And so I'm up there in the top grandstand and I wave to one of my friends who's a player down there. You know, I recognize him all right. But I don't know whether he'd pick me out among all the hands up there. And so I'd rather say this is not an issue that we can really talk about. There's absolutely no information on it. Old Testament or New Testament. One more, and then maybe we'll move one over here, and then we'll move on, maybe. Maybe we won't.
We're surrounded in our area in Chicago by several cemeteries. One is the Lutheran Cemetery, St. Lucas, and on their sign they say, asleep in the Lord.
Okay. There's no problem with that for me.
It's a quotation. It's
that's in the Bible, too. Paul uses the phrase, asleep, and we have a hymn about asleep in Jesus, blessed sleep. I don't know whether it's in the new hymnal or not, but most of you have heard it. From the point of view of the people who are surviving, again, the people who are staying in time, the body is asleep. The eyes are closed, there's no motion, and time then, if you want to use time again, for them passes just like a dream. Remember how many hours and months and years you could sometimes go through in a dream like that and wake up and it's been less than a 30-second dream? So the time is gone in a dream. And so Dorothy's sleep, if you want to use that, she didn't know whether she slept 26 years or 26 minutes or 26 seconds or 26 milliseconds. The resurrection like that. So I'm not saying there isn't any sleep, but it's from our point of view. One more question, and then we really maybe ought to move on a little.
I just want to say this gives me some good vibes, because since my husband died, I've often felt the presence of him, mm-hmm. especially when I'm in a time of turmoil or trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always a warmth with it, and it calms me.
Mm-hmm.
And when he died, I had him cremated because I felt he was returning to his Creator.
Mm-hmm.
And so it gave me a good concept. I never could buy that many people off the
separation.
Uh-huh.
And what you're feeling about in your relationship with your husband is very similar. I guess he's back here now, the man who was sitting over here. There he is over there. About the people who appeared or were seen in heaven. You know, if they were seen at all, they were totally seen.
It could be the Comforter, the Holy Spirit, but I definitely have felt that, and it's made a difference.
Fine.
In how I felt.
Glad you shared that with us. Let's look at some of the things that the Old Testament does say about parts. Let's first of all say the Old Testament, and I'll get to the New Testament, I hope, before quarter of. But this was the doctrine of humanity in the Old Testament, so if I don't get to the New Testament, I don't feel like I've cheated you too much. But well, first of all, we're saying that soul and body are not separate entities in Hebrew. There is only a self, a total person, a whole human being. That's it. Now, they use some other words besides breath and livingness. They use the word heart, for example, which is lev, L-E-V. And when my heart cries out, or when my heart has something, we usually think of heart as St. Valentine's Day, emotions kind of thing. Heart is the closest thing to the word mind or intellect that the Hebrew has. They thought you funk down here. They, you know, Harvey hadn't lived yet. Not the rabbit, but the guy who had blood circulation. Harvey was a modern discovery of the heart and the circulatory system and all that. And St. Valentine's is a medieval mythology about emotions in the heart. You know, my heart flutters when I see my lover or whatever kind of thing. It really is my heart that flutters. I'll tell you about that in a minute. What does flutter? Some of you have been going to the nurse to get some help, kind of. heart is usually used for mind or intellect. Occasionally it might mean the total person. See, a part can be used for the whole again. Then there's the bowels, or the stomach, or the liver. And those are the emotions. The ulcers, the colitis, the constipation. You know, we all know those that have a lot of emotional connections nowadays, don't we? Because of psychosomatic medicine. Well, the Hebrews were way ahead of us. They knew that when you were in love, or whether you were mad, it was down here in your intestines that you were feeling it. And that's the words they use. They used intestines, they used bowels, they used liver for the emotions. They didn't have a word for here. They used the word head, rosh, but they didn't think in terms of brain. They didn't know that brain was the functioning area for intellectual capacity. Heart did that for them. So let's just look at a couple of passages that I think might help you on that, and then I want to deal with death again on some of these. I guess the best one is Psalm 16:9, because that then helps us go into the problem of death right away in 16:10. Turn to Psalm 16. There are loads of passages we could look at, but our time is getting away from us awfully fast. Verse 9. Look at verse 9 only first. I'm going to go to verse 10 in a minute, but let's try to stay with these parts of the human being. Remember Psalm 103, bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me, bless his holy name. Things that are equal to the same thing are equal to each other. Things that do the same thing are often the same thing. Look at the second or the third part of a psalm verse, and you get the meaning. Look what you have in that. Somebody want to read 9 for me in any translation?
Therefore my heart is glad, and my glory rejoices. My flesh also shall rest in hope.
Okay. You've got three words. You've got heart, glory, and flesh. Is that what you used?
Yes.
Okay. My translation happens to have heart, soul, and body. Mm-hmm. Who cares what three words they're talking about at the moment? You see, because all three in that verse are trying to say, I in my totality am happy and secure. All of me. It's my heart. If you want to say it's my mind at that point, that's all right. And then my soul would be my breath, if you want to say that. And then my flesh, if you want to say that. But that's not what they're saying. They're saying, I'm so full of the joy of the Lord that there's nothing in me that isn't rejoicing. And it's an attempt to say, heart, soul, body. Or heart, glory, I think you said was the second word in your translation. And flesh.
The good news doesn't mention any of them.
What's good news say? Let's hear it.
And so I am thankful and glad, and I feel complete.
Isn't that nice? I like that. You see, the good news was written originally for basic English. I don't know whether you knew that. Good News Bible was originally written with a limitation of 800 basic verbs and basic nouns. They found that the Bible was a little bit more complicated than that, so they added a few extras. But they eliminated all those, and they got the sense, my heart equals me, or I, my soul equals me, or I, my body equals me, or I, and they translated. So they could eliminate all those words like glory and soul in that particular passage. Just say, I rejoice. That's basic English comes in help now and then. Okay? Do you follow how what we're saying about this? Now, we could read passages about kidneys and bowels if you want to, but they're all the same thing. When my bowels are upset, I'm upset. When I'm constipated, I'm constipated, not just my bowels. You know that as well as I do. I don't have to be an MD to tell you that. It's rather simple just to look at it that way. Now, look at verse 10 because that's an important one. And we're going to have three or four different translations here. The idea of what happens to that body after death has always bothered people. And the Old Testament has several words. It uses grave, it uses pit, it uses Sheol, it uses father's house. It uses a number of things like that, or gathered to the fathers. Those are the general words. And here we have two of them. Somebody want to read verse 10?
For you will not leave me among the dead. You will not allow your beloved one to rot in the grave.
Okay. See, they made it clear. Which translation is that?
That's the Living Bible.
That's the Living Bible. Fine. And although the Living Bible at times is a paraphrase, in that particular one, they're right hitting the nail on the head.
I have it in for the Living Bible.
Yeah, there are many passages that are wrong in the Living Bible because they're interpreted it.
This seems like a minor matter.
Go ahead.
But there's a passage in Nehemiah. Go your way and celebrate. Eat the fat and drink the wine. And these fellows must have been prohibitionists. There's no wine in it there.
Okay.
Look it up.
All you Lutherans, just when you get to that passage in the Living Bible, amend it. Say, Ed was an editor once, and he wants you to edit it.
No, the thing that throws me there, if they take liberties with a passage like that and cut the wine out, how do I know but to what they've cut something else out that ought to be in there?
I think I just said that, Ed, that they interpret rather than translate.
Thank you, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's all right.
You always have to read the two versions.
You must read more than one version. That one happens to be a correct translation. As Ed says, they're not all correct. Many of them are interpretive. And some of them you've got to be checked with. But in the RSV, they use the word Sheol and pit.
Yeah.
In the King James, anybody have a King James?
Hell.
It uses hell and grave, I think, doesn't it?
For thou wilt not leave my soul in hell, neither wilt thou suffer thine holy one to see corruption.
Oh, corruption. Okay. You see the differences? But what do they say? Whether it's Sheol, hell, pit, grave, corruption, they're all talking about death, aren't they? They're all talking about where the body goes when the spirit has been taken away from it.
This one's pretty good because you protect me from the power of death, and the one you love, you will not abandon to the world of the dead.
All right. Okay.
Isn't it interesting that verse 10 takes these three words, heart, soul, and body, and uses the pronoun me?
Right. And godly
that's
one.
Interpretive too.
Right. Sure it is. You can't say that he's going to put only my heart in the grave or in the pit. He won't let my heart see the grave. Thanks for adding that interpretation.
That really sounds like you are immediately resurrected.
Well, that's the next word we're going to deal with if we have time. Yesterday, someday in the last couple of days, somebody said, what's the word save really mean? And save. And of course, salvation and salve, when my mother used to put goose liver on my, that was kind of a salve, right? Goose grease? Goose grease, I missed my point. I guess she hung the goose liver under, okay. But anyhow, a salve and salvation are from the same Latin word. They both mean heal. And that's why psychosomatic medicine doesn't do anything about our definition of salvation. You know, Jesus said, which is it easier, to say, rise, take up your bed and walk, or your sins are forgiven? For God, who is the spirit of life and forgiveness and health, to heal And to save is the same thing. When I'm resurrected, I'm fully healed, if I want to use it that way, because I am resurrected perfect and full, and all crippling, all illnesses, all decay, that's all gone. So when you take, when you hear the word, and that's, I'm getting to your question, maybe like a long, well, it was about the business of that he's going to let you be resurrected right away in the Old Testament. Yeah, he made a comment. Save could mean keep me from getting deathly ill. Rescue me from the edge of the abyss. Often means don't let me die. Don't let them kick me in the grave. Rescue me. So the word Jesus, of course, we translate most of the time, he shall save his people from the sins. But it also means rescue. It also means grab somebody from the burning fire, which went out. All of those things are involved in this. So,
in fact, on the cross.
Right, same thing. Same thing. That's a good illustration. Was he healed or saved or both? The obvious is they say the same thing. They heal each other. So, the Old Testament, primarily when it uses the word save, or when it uses the word rescue, or when it uses salvation, it's primarily talking about escape from temporary death. It's not talking about escape from eternal death. It's not talking about that. There are only, I got four passages that you can guess might have some hint of resurrection in it. The Old Testament didn't talk a lot about. To be guided to the fathers didn't mean Abraham's bosom. It meant being in the family tomb, where they had, if you've been in Jerusalem, the tomb of the kings, or the up near the French Quarter, you go through a little tomb and there are eight or nine different little cubicles where they could put two or three bodies on several levels, and the whole family would be gathered together. So grandpa's there, and grandma's there, and dad's there, and my little brother's there, and some other people are there, and when I die, they gather me to my father's, which means grave, or corruption, or pit, or whatever, and that's all that meant. Let's look at the passages. I think we do that. There are only two passages that really talk of resurrection or life after death in the Old Testament. There are three other passages that use it as a metaphor for the rescue or the revivification or the return of Israelites to life. After the Israelite nation has been in captivity, then they use the term as if it's resurrection. The easiest one you know about that is the Valley of the Dry Bones, Ezekiel. Them bones will live again, and them dry bones, and I'm not going to sing, Ed does the singing no. in the Bible studies, not I. So, you know, that's really a picture of the restoration of Israel after the captivity. But it's using the analogy that God's Spirit makes them bones live. Them bones don't live just because them bones have life in them or get a soul. The Spirit, the wind of the Lord comes and raises them. And that's what we're talking about. They're using the correct analogy, but they're talking about a nation. Now that also happens to be true in Hosea, the sixth chapter, which is often used in the New Testament as the prediction of the resurrection of Jesus after 3 days. It also talks about after a short time, Israel will be rescued.
What was the first passage that you read?
First passage, I'm sorry, was Ezekiel 37. I just said dry bones, but didn't give you the chapter. Hosea 6, chapter 6, verse 2, is the one that's quoted in the New Testament. Now, the two that are very clear about a possible life after death, Isaiah 26, verse 14, and you need to look at verse 19 as well. So if you can turn to Isaiah, we'll look at that one. There are only two clear passages about resurrection. That's why the New Testament is so different from the Old Testament. The hope of eternal life and resurrection is a Christian belief. It's a New Testament belief. And the Jews of Jesus' time had two different or three different theories about life after death. Not based on the Bible, based on their own theory. Chapter 26 in Isaiah. Can somebody read verse 14 for me, please?
They're dead. They will not live. They are saved. They will not arise. To that end, thou hast visited them with destruction, and
wiped out all remembrance of it.
Now, if you read the verses ahead of that, that doesn't sound like you're going to have much eternal life, does it? Sort of wiped them out. The word wiped out is really there. This is the enemies. If you read the couple of passages ahead of that, it's the enemies of Israel. And they don't have any hope of eternal life. They've just been wiped out and the slate's clean. But now if you move down, people say to themselves, gee, is that going to happen to all the Israelites who've been martyred, all the Israelites who kept the covenant? And they begin to worry about verse 19. Somebody read that one.
The dead man shall live, together with my dead body shall they arise. Awake and sing, ye that dwell in dust, for thy dew is as the dew of herbs, and the earth shall cast out the dead.
Okay, the dead shall live, my body or their body shall arise, the dwellers in the dust are going to get up and sing. Now that is very clear, isn't it, that there's going to be some kind of life.
Okay, is that for the faithful then?
Yes, that's for the Israelite faithful. Mm-hmm. At this point, and even up to Jesus' time, there was one group of Jews who said only the faithful get eternal life or get resurrected. The rest, because they hadn't developed a complete doctrine of hell yet. Sheol, you remember we just looked it up in Psalm 16, was really grave or death or father's house or pit or corruption or something. So in this passage, you've got an idea of half of a resurrection. Verse 14 says, those Babylonians or those Assyrians or those Persians or those Romans or those Americans or those Vietnamese or whatever the enemy happened to be, they ain't going to get nothing. But the faithful, us Israelites, us Christians, us loyal group of Pharisees, we'll get something, and that's verse 19.
What do we get?
What do we get where? We get to live, that's all. We don't know. They don't say much more.
Does the word remembrance in verse 14 have any...
They're remembered by God, and they sing for joy. That's about as far as we can go.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, the other passage, which is a little later in time for many people's ideas, is from Daniel. Daniel 12, verse 2. This is the only place, in the whole Old Testament where you have everybody raised, and even here it says some, but that some could be for the two halves, and some go one way and some go the other way. Daniel is the only passage in the whole Old Testament that talks about a resurrection which is going to separate us. The other separated us by having some of us live and the rest of us not live. The Isaiah passage, this one. Somebody want to read that verse for me, verse 2 in chapter 12.
And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt.
Read verse 3 too, I think it's fine.
All right. And those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever.
Okay.
Wait a minute.
That's it. Yeah, that's it. Daniel is writing in a time when martyrs were around, just like Paul was writing in a time when there were martyrs around. And when Paul talks about these people who are martyrs will not be lost, they'll also inherit life, he was talking to all those Jewish people who thought that many of the dead won't arise, and only those who are ready for the rapture will be caught up in the air. So Daniel's saying the same thing. All you people that the Persians, where the Babylonians or the Assyrians have killed in captivity, you're not going to lose out. You're going to be rewarded for your faithfulness to the covenant, for your witnessing to the covenant, and you'll get the reward. Again, it doesn't say what the reward is. Shining like a star doesn't really tell me much as to what they'll get or what they'll look like. It's an image of what's going on.
Well, this one doesn't give me any hope. It says, the Lord has an accusation to bring against the people of Judah. He is also going to punish Israel for the way her people act. He will pay them back for what they have done.
That's 12:2. Okay, now that's what Ed's talking about. That's such a strong interpretation. It's merely saying that some who are faithful are going to get rewarded and some who are not faithful are going to get punished. That's about what you're trying to say.
Mention the faithful, though.
No, it doesn't use that word. Just says some. Now, the only other passage, and I'm going to take time because I'm already over time, and I do want to make one statement about the New Testament. The only other passage that is sometimes quoted about resurrection is Job 19. You know, that's the passage that you often read.
I know that my Redeemer liveth.
Right, I know that my Redeemer liveth, and has all the other things about it. But the passage that is usually translated, and though I die, yet from my flesh will I see God, the Hebrew is so mixed up, nobody really knows what that verse means. You just have to say you really don't. And even if you translate it into English, out of my flesh is the King James. Does that mean without flesh? Or does that mean from within my flesh? Even the English doesn't make any sense in the King James. From out my flesh, I will see God. Now let's deal with the New Testament in three sentences, real quickly, because the time is up and it's going to be coffee hour in a minute. In the New Testament, you sometimes hear body and soul. You sometimes hear body, mind, and spirit. You sometimes hear body, mind, and soul. You sometimes hear what people say is a two-part definition of humanity. Sometimes three parts, but the three parts aren't always the same. And even in the same guy who's writing, Paul, sometimes has three words, but they're three different Greek words sometimes. So, the simplest explanation is very simply this, and then I want to close with Jesus on the cross. Simplest explanation is, Paul was a Hebrew who knew Hebrew, he spoke Aramaic, he was writing in Greek. If he wanted to tell the Greeks about the totality of the human being, the living being of the Old Testament, that all of me is going to be resurrected, he has to use their language, right? They had no word other than if they'd have said the words, all of me, but then they'd have said, what do you mean? Which parts count? They'd have gone into Vern Rieke's kind of Socratic method and pushed Paul in the corner. So he said, very simply, anything you say it has to take to make up the total person, that's it. So sometimes he says body and soul, that's totality for some Greeks. Sometimes he says body, soul, and mind, that's totality for some Greeks. Sometimes he says body, mind, and spirit. What he's really saying is the total human being. And when he says, may the Lord bless you in your body and your spirit, or body and soul, as he does in another passage, he's really saying, may the Lord bless all of you. Every bit of you, if you want to use this thing, because all of you is like drinky all of it, which is ambiguous too in the English. Now, when Jesus died on the cross, whether you emphasize his human side at that point or whether you emphasize his divine side, it says in Luke very simply, he died and gave up the ghost. The word in Greek does not have the word ghost in it. That's only a King James phrase. It was added. It's not there. It's just he died and expired, or gave a last gasp, is what the Greek really means. But he said in another passage, he said, into your hands I commit what?
My spirit.
Now, if you take him from the God point of view, he's saying, God the Father, here comes our power. The spirit, the power. That's Luke. If you take the man side of it, he's merely using the point of view of saying, I'm about to die. Because once the spirit is away, you die. You follow? Once God's supporting vitality is taken away, you die. So that passage of Jesus fits in with this very easily. Either from the divine side or the human side. You can take it either way, and it makes perfectly good sense. When he died, had a last gasp, after he had said, I commit my spirit. Now, he used the pronoun, my spirit, and I tend to think that has something to say about the divinity. If he had said, I commend thy spirit, or a spirit, it might have emphasized his humanity, but I wouldn't want to split those hairs because it fits both ways. Okay, sorry we didn't have two or three more hours on this. One more question and then we'll close.
I just wanted to make a comment. When you watch people die, you really get that understanding, because even if you're in a coma, as long as the spirit is there, there's still life. But as soon as that goes, it's as if it's all written away.
And the interesting thing about it is, the word for breath or the word for spirit is the same. The word for life and the word for breath is the same. So when breath goes, life goes, for their point of view. When the spirit goes, there ain't no umhow anymore. Thank you very much.
Thank you.